Italy, you know, same thing.
Sure.
Which is exactly the same figures you have for Greece and for, absolutely, you know, Spain and Portugal and so on. So, you know, this is why we see Hollande doing this, because he knows that if he doesn't do this, it's going to collapse.
Right.
And he doesn't want it to happen under the social democrats and the socialists. They're going to be like, oh, the socialists are not good for the economy. Sure. Well,
but anyway, whatever. But in the last minute or so, I think, Dr. Tarabi, it really is, I think, symptomatic of the disaster in terms of leadership in the West, that, you know, that they're down to that kind of level now, that even somebody like Putin, an ex-KGB man, finds it abhorrent that, you know, this is the you know,
that's a good point, actually.
yeah that this is what they're come down to. But anyway, I'm sorry, we've run out of time, but thanks very much for your valuable contribution today. Thanks very much for being on the program. It just leaves me to say to our audience, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you very much for listening to the program today, and goodbye.
Pangolins might look tough with their scaly armor, but they are in fact highly vulnerable animals. A Vietnamese man is dedicating his time and energy to making sure they are safe. 39-year-old Thai has been protecting pangolins since his boyhood, when he saw one brutally hunted by his neighbors. The bitter experience inspired him to find or make a group devoted to saving the endangered species. Save Vietnam's Wildlife has over 60 staff and has so far rescued around 1,600 pangolins. Thai says seeing the rescued animals return to nature is the best part of his job.
The most wonderful moments in the lives of all of the conservationists at my center are the moments that we witness the rescued pangolins getting out from the transportation cages and slowly walking into the forest, because the forest is their true home, where they can have the joy of living their lives in their own way.
Pangolins are one of the most trafficked mammals in the world. Their number have fallen due to illegal trade. The animals, now critically endangered, could once be found in the rainforests across Asia and Africa. They use their sticky tongues to hunt for ants, termites, and similar prey. People around the world have their unique ways of celebrating events. In Nepal, farmers and locals celebrate National Paddy Day by jumping into muddy fields. The festival marks the start of the annual rice planting season. People joyfully sing and play in muddy water. Another popular tradition on this day is eating a mixture of curd and beaten rice with friends and family. The fun event usually draws many tourists from around the world. However, this year, it is limited only to locals due to the coronavirus pandemic. Rice is the most important crop in Nepal and accounts for almost half of the cereal production in the country. The pandemic has not stopped this British musician from holding live concerts. His audience is a very special group in Danish rural areas. Jacob Shaw, a university professor, is the man behind this experiment. He says playing for the animals has been his second best option after the pandemic forced the cancellation of many events and social gatherings. Shaw says the performance for the cows has been so rewarding that he wants to continue it even after public spaces are reopened. He says the cows seem to enjoy classical music very much.
They react
differently to different pieces. We played something that was slightly more upbeat, a little bit more modern, and a lot of them didn't like it and they went away. And I think that the type of pieces which is closer to their voice, closer to their mooing, which could be similar actually to a cello, which is why it's so successful with them, they prefer that.
The cello player is sometimes accompanied by other musicians. They say the experience has helped them practice and also relieve some of the stress of a live concert.
Science fiction has turned into reality, or at least that's how the developer of AirCar describes his vehicle when it transforms from a car into an aircraft in less than 3 minutes. This prototype flying car was designed and created by Slovakian transportation professor Stefan Klein. He says that his design opens a new category in transportation. The dual-mode vehicle composed a 35-minute flight in this week between the two Slovakian airports. So far, it has completed more than 40 hours of test flight. AirCar can fly about 1,000 kilometers at a height of over 2,500 meters. That makes the dream of those who wish to ride above traffic closer to reality. A digital art museum in the Japanese capital has unveiled a stunning exhibition offering visitors an intimate interaction with nature. One of the attractions of the show is Floating Flower Garden, which is a mirrored room filled with 13,000 orchid flowers. The orchids are dangling from the ceiling and move up once a visitor walks through in the space and approaches the flowers. Once the visitors move past, the flowers descend again. This makes the visitors able to freely wander around the three-dimensional flower mass space. Tokyo-based digital art group Team Lab that runs this exhibition says the artwork is designed to help people think that they are part of the garden.
This is an installation filled with these flowers. As you walk towards them, the flowers slowly move up to create an area of space for you. Surrounded so completely by flowers, you feel immersed in the flowers, the garden itself.
There are several other installations in this exhibition. One is an outdoor piece filled with Ovid sculptures that light up after the sun sets. Visitors can see 61 different colors of light in this section. When one of the Ovids tipped over by a hand or the wind, it emits a sound. The sound is then echoed by the surrounding Ovids. In a school in the Ukrainian capital, kids learn about saving the environment and helping those in need through a creative way. Students put plastic bottles in a machine as currency. Then they can select what they would like to spend money on. Buying food for stray animals and donating to children with special needs are some of the choices. The project was first launched in a mall in Kiev a few months ago. Afterwards, the designers found out that children were the most frequent users of this machine.
A child drops a bottle inside and sees an immediate result. It brings joy and happiness, and everyone is excited and wants the project to thrive.
The founders seek to install more and more machines in schools across Ukraine to raise environmental awareness among younger generations. Since the start of the project in October last year, over 5 tons of plastic has been collected from 6 machines.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
India is known not only for its cultural diversity, but also for a vibrant assortment of uncountable dishes. Butter chicken is the only one delight you wouldn't like to miss while visiting Indian restaurants, especially if it is prepared by a celebrity chef like Saransh Goyla. Goyla's coal-fired oven is now sending a mouth-watering scent through India's commercial hub, Mumbai, as the young chef takes a break from COVID-19 relief efforts and resumes work. He is the one who established the first global butter chicken brand and authored the acclaimed food travelogue, India on My Platter. But with the coronavirus forcing people into isolation, his networks were also hit. So Goyla launched a non-profit platform called COVID Meals for India in April to connect thousands of volunteer home cooks and frontline workers.
The pandemic had a large impact on our business. Having said that, Goyla Butter Chicken from the start was always focused on deliveries and takeaway. So in that sense, our loss of revenue and a loss of business was slightly lesser than an average restaurant. But a lot of my friends, restaurateurs who are in this industry have gone through an extremely tough time. The pandemic has taken its toll on our industry, and I think it has set us back by at least a couple of years.
Goyla found his calling early, winning a televised cooking competition at the age of 25, which led him to host a travel program showcasing regional Indian cuisine. His profile exploded in 2018 when he was invited by former MasterChef Australia judge George Kalambaris to be a guest on the hit show, with contestants asked to recreate his signature dish.
Graduation is an exciting moment for all schoolgoers, but the occasion turns more joyful if it ends with a celebration like Scarlet Sales Festival, which is held in St. Petersburg in Russia at the end of the school year. The annual event is part of the famous White Nights Festival, traditionally held in summer, with spectacular fireworks, numerous music concerts, and a massive water show. Normally, thousands of domestic and foreign tourists flock to the city to watch the colorful event. But this year, the COVID-19 pandemic limited the number of the attendees. The festival began in the 1960s when several Russian schools united to celebrate the end of the academic year. That is in connection with the symbolism of the popular 1922 children's book, Scarlet Sails, by Alexander Grin. Indonesia is dealing with a surge in coronavirus infections, but that has not stopped the people from observing the Yatnya Kasada Festival. Thousands of people braved the climb to the summit of Mount Bromo in eastern Java province to observe the ancient ritual. They made offerings ranging from fruits and crops to livestock by throwing the items to the pit of an active volcano. They believe the practice brings blessings and plenitude and helps them express gratitude for what they have. This year's festival was overshadowed by the coronavirus pandemic, with participants required to adhere to strict health protocols. China's space agency has released videos of its first Mars rover as it's exploring the red planet's surface. The rover is named Zhurong. It's now investigating a vast plane known as Utopia Planitia on Mars's northern hemisphere. The robot successfully landed on Mars in mid-May. It is studying the red planet's surface rocks and atmosphere. It also looks for signs of life, including any subsurface water or ice. The solar-powered Chinese robot weighs around 240 kilograms and has 6 wheels. China is the second country after the U.S. to operate a rover on Mars. A university in the Venezuelan capital Caracas has turned its roof into a garden and uses sustainable energy to light up its classes. The roof of Andres Bello Catholic University is covered with plants and 30 solar panels. The panels along with a wind turbine produced the 7,400 watts of electricity to illuminate that area and light two rooms in the building. The roof is now functioning as a self-sufficient and environmentally friendly open-air classroom. The proposal for the project was put forward by two students. The aim is to educate people about renewable energy and the threat of climate change.
A small New Hampshire town has been hit by a series of car break-ins over the last few weeks. People were shocked when they finally discovered the mischievous criminal. A large black bear has been identified as the bandit wreaking havoc in the town of Thornton. The naughty mammal was caught on camera as it got on its two hind legs and skillfully opened the door of a car. Police say the bear was most likely rummaging for food. Authorities have asked people to remove food from their cars to avoid enticing the troublesome animal. A Jordanian woman is receiving high demands for the soap she produces. Why? Because she uses an unusual ingredient. Lara Altiti makes soap out of camel milk. She tours different cities in Jordan to find the best camel farms for her business. Titi uses camel milk as the major ingredient for the soap she produces. That's because she says it has rich benefits and contains more vitamins than cow milks.
The first stage includes weighing the soap, and I include different kinds of oil to preserve the quality of the soap and its therapeutic benefit. We need to have high foam and tough consistency, and we don't want it to be rancid. We place high importance on the therapeutic material that we add during the production process.
Titi started her soap line at home using a manual process and then expanded it to an independent workshop. Her soap line has now become very popular in Jordan. Titi produces more than 4,000 soap bars a month. She tells them to both sells them both to domestic and international customers.
The German firm's electric air taxi takes its first flight at a show in an airport near the French capital, Paris. Volocopter's flying taxi, which looks like a tiny helicopter, took off and landed vertically over the airport with no passenger on board during a three-minute trial. Aside from its two-passenger capacity, the aircraft also has some room for luggage. It flew a 500-meter route at speeds of up to 30 kilometers per hour and 30 meters high along the airfield. The flying taxi service would first be operated by a licensed pilot, but the flight would be fully automated over a period of time.
With respect to regulation, initially we will have a fully certified, fully licensed helicopter pilot just to fit into existing regulation. But we believe over time it can be much simpler to obtain such an operating license for a volocopter. And of course, in the last instance, we want to take a pilot requirement out and we want these vehicles to fly fully automated. So you will not need a pilot license anymore. You can just summon the volocopter, it will come and pick you up and bring you safely to your destination.
The German firm is entering the urban mobility market with high hopes of playing a major role in the infant industry. Volocopter says its objective is to have a service in operation for 2024 for the 2024 Olympic Games.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The Irish Taoiseach Michael Martin has called on Downing Street to reciprocate the generosity of spirit shown by EU leaders on the Northern Ireland Protocol after they extended the grace period allowing chilled meats to be shipped to the nation from Britain. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist Mata Busby. The piece is titled, Irish Taoiseach Urges Number 10 to Match EU Generosity Over Northern Ireland Protocol. Stay with us for more of Mata Busby's article. Irish Taoiseach Michael Martin has called on Number 10 Downing Street to reciprocate the generosity of spirit shown by European Union leaders on the Northern Ireland Protocol after they extended the grace period allowing chilled meats to be shipped to the nation from Britain. On Saturday, 3rd of July, Michael Martin said, "Warning each other is over," and called for engagement to find solutions through the withdrawal agreement. It came after UK cabinet ministers ramped up pressure for concessions on the protocol by warning of disruption to peace if changes are not made. The Irish Taoiseach Michael Martin said, "I think the British government should acknowledge the approach of the European Union this week in terms of the extension of the grace period and also in terms of the facilitation around the medicines issue. There is no question that the European Commission and the European Union leaders have demonstrated goodwill and a generosity of spirit towards the British government in resolving this issue. It really is time for British government to reciprocate the generosity of spirit that European leaders have shown, and also the sense of flexibility that Europe has indicated to the United Kingdom that it is willing to deploy in respect of working out the issues pertaining to the protocol. The time for warning each other is over. It's time for engagement, constructive engagement, with a view to reaching a solution." The European Union decision on chilled meats, after a request from the United Kingdom, avoids a trade dispute by delaying the ban until 30th of September this year, while efforts continue to find a lasting solution to measures which prevent a hard border in Ireland. British government accepted as Annex 2 of the protocol a measure stating that chilled meats, including meat preparations such as sausages, have to be sent frozen into the bloc from non-EU states without a mutual and all-encompassing veterinary agreement. Britain's decision not to align with European Union standards in plant and animal products has led to a range of sanitary checks on plant and animal products. UK cabinet ministers have been calling for concessions on the Northern Ireland Protocol, saying that a seriously unbalanced situation has developed in the operation of the agreement. In a joint article in the Irish Times, Brexit Minister Lord Frost and Northern Ireland Secretary Brendan Lewis said this week's extension of a grace period in the so-called sausage war was welcome, but addresses only a small part of the underlying problem. The pair warned the European Union that the Northern Ireland Protocol, negotiated as part of the Brexit deal, risks damage to the Good Friday Agreement, which in 1998 helped to secure peace in Northern Ireland after decades of sectarian violence, unless a new balance is found in terms of customs checks. Lord Frost and Northern Ireland Secretary Brendan Lewis urged Brussels to adopt a softer approach to the implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol, which the former helped to negotiate. It comes after talk of tariffs over the UK's failure to implement the Irish Protocol in the withdrawal agreement. The potential prohibition on chilled meats from Britain is one result of the Northern Ireland Protocol, which has created a series of economic barriers on Irish sea trade to retain the integrity of the European Union. The protocol is aimed at avoiding a hard border with Ireland by, in effect, keeping Northern Ireland in the European Union's single market for goods. But unionists in Northern Ireland have complained that terms are splitting Northern Ireland from Britain and harming business, with some British products not available in shops in Northern Ireland due to extra costs for retailers. The United Kingdom has repeatedly rejected a temporary Switzerland-style agreement with the European Union, under which the UK would align with Brussels' rulebook for a period and 80% of the checks would no longer have to take place. Meanwhile, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who held talks with the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson at Chequers in Buckinghamshire on Friday, expressed optimism that a pragmatic solution can be reached on the Northern Ireland Protocol. Boris Johnson, speaking at a joint press conference with Angela Merkel, said he hoped the worst is behind us when it came to the chilled meat saga.
The subcontinent.
Hello everyone, this is Mehdi and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people. In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to discuss the negative and at times hateful representation or stereotyping of subcontinental ethnicities, religions, and traditional roots in the Western mass media. And we will try to dissect the factors perpetuating such deep misconceptions throughout the Western culture and societies. In today's world, we are greatly influenced by what we read and watch in media. Most of the people learn about the cultures of the world through their representations in different types of media productions they consume. But what do you do if media companies or outlets, especially those with the greatest number of audiences, try to show a small sliver of the complex realities of a culture or country? Like many other ethnicities or cultures, Indians are victims of negative or hateful stereotyping, particularly in Western media productions.
Exchange of information has never been this easy throughout the human history, but like any other feats of human advancement, this comes with its own caveats. Today, most of the people learn about the world from media, which is filled with cases of misrepresentation and false news, and the prejudice against Indians or the subcontinental culture in general has been manifesting itself in many ways, from insults on social media to bigoted remarks by high-ranking officials or authorities. No matter where they live, modern human beings rely heavily on what the media show and tell them about the current global affairs. But India's image in media is sometimes far from the truth. People, especially in Western countries, associate India with all the cliches and stereotypes that their media firms are feeding them, which is vastly dominated by stories about environmental or social problems such as poverty, drought, heat or pollution.
A negative stereotype is a label that purports to describe the undesirable, objectionable or unacceptable qualities and characteristics of the members of a particular group or social category. Stereotypes may have some truth in their kernels, but they may never represent an accurate picture. One may think that people are not as likely to be typecast by their looks, accents, or ethnicities as they once were. But some of these negative and untrue representations about the subcontinent are sunken to the collective consciousness of Westerners, because these are all they are hearing from India.
The human mind is riddled with a lot of biases that can mess up its perception of the world. Some of these biases fit best the propaganda of many media companies that know and sometimes manipulate their audience through them. Confirmation and selection biases make people resonate with the ideas they know as prior knowledge, so it is natural for people to look for the information that confirm their pre-existing presumptions about something, even if these assumptions are narrow or all-out wrong. This is how Western media make their mark. Audiences pay attention to stories that confirm their prior beliefs. Therefore, they select and repeat stories that portray the subcontinent in a way that serves their agenda. The general audience who are not exposed to the current affairs in the subcontinent may not be able to fathom the linguistic, ethnic, religious, and cultural diversity of this vast area. Building up the expertise to understand the Indian subcontinent cannot happen overnight. Even Indians themselves can't claim that they know everything about their culture, let alone foreign reporters or media producers who only spend some time there and think they've seen it all.
The subcontinental history is marred with myriads of atrocities by Western and European colonialists during the British Raj, a period of direct British rule over the Indian subcontinent from 1858 until the independence of India and Pakistan in 1947. In 1700, India was the world's richest country, accounting for some 27% of the global GDP. But in 1947, when India achieved its independence, India had been reduced to one of the world's poorest countries with just over 3% of global GDP. During this period, the British decimated the Indian economy and culture. The British took thriving industries like textiles, shipbuilding, and steel and destroyed them through violence, taxes, and import tariffs, as well as imposing their exports and products. Yet, they still seem to dislike the Indians and their culture.
Although imperialist powers have a long history of subjugating the Indian subcontinent, most people in the so-called first world countries don't know a lot about its people and cultures. Lack of knowledge did not make them curious to know the peculiarities of this land and its habitats, but it solidified a wide range of misconceptions that were hugely intensified by the West-centric media. A recent study performed in the UK indicates that about 80% of British Indians have faced prejudice because of their Indian identity. Recently, a motion has been tabled in the UK Parliament condemning the rise in anti-Indian racism in the country. Moreover, a petition went viral online against an Oxford University faculty member
for his racist and Hindu-phobic remarks against the first female Indian student to be elected as the university's union president. Negative stereotypes represent negative expectations about the out-group, aggravating the predominant xenophobia or the us-and-them dichotomy that is etched in the primal parts of human brain. In the human brain, the prefrontal neocortex is the largest part of the cerebral cortex and is implicated in higher-order thinking and decision-making. Humans have evolved to go beyond their animalistic genes, but repetition of negative stereotyping mixed with misogyny, sexism, racism, and other biases have limited the worldview and cognitive orientation of many Western communities about the subcontinental identity.
The Indian subcontinent is a diverse, multi-ethnic area that is home to thousands of small ethnic and tribal groups. Considering its large population, the scale of everything is huge there. So it doesn't seem difficult to find instances of every kind of stories and characters. However, what you see most in media are not the success stories of myriads of Indian scientists or entrepreneurs, but a hackneyed depiction of poverty or sexual violence.
Diversities are a reason the world has thrived, and no society can ever flourish unless it values and respects such differences. However, the Western culture can't stand a planet with balanced view about different cultures and people. Their view of the world is tinted with a sense of superiority and cannot see people as equal. Thus, they try to project their own stereotypical portrayals about others with selective reporting and negative cliches. Given the variegated palette of cultural identities, understanding the complexities of the subcontinent and its current issues of public discourse looks extra perplexing for Western media companies. But the key factor behind their narrow and reductionist view about the Indian subcontinent is their political agendas. They focus on violence against women, Bollywood celebrities, odd incidents, or exotic animals to reinforce such stereotypes to make their audience believe this is all that is happening there. Then when independent journalists or alternative media outlets provide the needed context, reveal their hand, and criticize their dishonest representation, they play the freedom of speech card. Negative stereotypes are perpetuated as long as the majority of media is controlled by a few imperialist countries or corporates that benefit from more tribalism and xenophobia.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Paranjoy Guha Takota, an Indian journalist, writer, and a documentary maker. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Takota. I wanted to begin by saying Indians, unfortunately, like many other ethnicities or cultures, are victims of negative stereotyping or even hate crimes. Now, what do you think are the reasons or factors behind it?
Negative stereotyping, hate crimes are on the rise across the world. Because despite economic quote-unquote progress, people's outlook and their social outlook and their minds and their attitudes have not widened. So Indians, Asians, minorities across the world, they face negative stereotyping. And on occasions, this culminates in mob lynching and hate crime. In other parts of the world, we see Indians, irrespective of their religion, being stereotyped. But within India, though Hindus account for 80% of the population of India, we see Muslims being stereotyped. And we see Islamophobia, which is on the rise. And although 1 out of 7 Indians is Muslim, and there are more Muslims in India than in all countries in the world except one, and that is Indonesia, we see this kind of stereotyping of Muslims, just as we see in other parts of the world, in say the United Kingdom and other countries like that, Indians being stereotyped. They put all Indians in one category, whereas India is an extremely diverse country. India is the only country in the world with 17 languages on its currency note, excluding the language with which I'm conversing with you right now. It has 21 languages that can be used for official purposes. They are in the 8th schedule of the Constitution of India. But despite the diversity, the cultural diversity, the social diversity, everybody tends to put all 1.35 or 1.4 billion into one category. Many people across the world don't know the difference between Hindi, which is a language, and Hindu, which is a religion. So these kind of stereotypes are happening across the world, and certainly in India, it's also happening.
A recent study says 80% of British Indians have faced prejudice because of their Indian identity, and even a motion that has been tabled in the UK Parliament condemning the rise in anti-Indian racism in the country. Now, my question has two parts. Why the British don't like Indians, and what can be done about it?
I should not say that British don't like Indians and Indians don't like British. There's a section. There's a section in Britain that still perhaps are not reconciled, that Britain is no longer ruling over India, that India is no longer a colony. Today, Indians are, including members of parliament, are asking for reparations, compensation for colonial rule. Now, that has also aroused a lot of anger and agitation. But the fact is, if you look at the government, if you look at the government of Boris Johnson, and you'll find large numbers, a fairly substantial number of persons of Asian origin who are holding important positions. So yes, the stereotyping and the negative sort of stereotyping continues, but as I was mentioning earlier, this is happening despite so-called economic development. And when economies across the world there's been a downturn after the pandemic, after the corona pandemic, when the economy is in a bad shape, when unemployment is on the rise, when there are not enough jobs, these kinds of stereotyping, they take place. I mean, there are more and more people who take comfort or get this kind of very perverse kind of comfort in stereotyping. Maybe the word comfort is not the right word, but they have been indoctrinated and brainwashed into believing that their problems are because of the other. And when you say the other, the enemy, you tend to focus on minorities, you tend to focus on people whose color of their skin is different from yours. And we see this happening across the world, and it's not just in the United Kingdom. We've seen it happening in the United States, and we saw the reaction, the Black Lives Matter movement. We see this across the world. We see this particularly in countries which are ruled by right-wing demagogues. So at one level, this is a phenomenon, it's a global phenomenon.
Thank you, Mr. Takorta. Now let's take a look at how the global media talk about the negative profiling of the subcontinental culture.
Indian misrepresentation in media has been prevalent since Indian characters emerged in American entertainment. Indians have constantly been inaccurately represented in TV shows and movies, further contributing to false images about their personalities and culture. Redefining the stereotypes Indians have become subject to is the only way Indians will begin to feel like their culture is respected. Language is a powerful medium through which unconscious bias and prejudice against certain nationalities is reinforced. Research shows that jokes which rely on stereotypes towards certain groups and communities create a climate where discrimination is normalized, shifting the social milestones for what constitutes racism and xenophobia. People must address this normalized language and understand the impact that unconscious biases have if we want to live in a country which is equal and fair, and where people like me are not judged or ridiculed based on the color of our skin. Abhijit Sarkar, an Oxford University faculty who had unleashed the Hindu-phobic attack against Rashmi Samant, the first female Indian student to be elected as president of the Oxford University Students' Union, is now facing the heat from netizens. An online petition against Abhijit Sarkar has gone viral on Twitter. The petition demands that Oxford University should investigate Abhijit Sarkar's nasty demeanor on social media and suspend him till the investigations are done. The British national curriculum needs to better educate students on colonial history and its impact, setting up a task force to understand the impacts of colonialism on modern Britain is a necessary first step. Indian languages should be offered as an option at schools, particularly given India's economic growth. This would be similar to how Mandarin is offered in many schools. There should be more opportunities for adults to learn Indian languages, to connect with their heritage, and to act as a living bridge between the two countries.
Sorry for the wait, Mr. Takota. As you know, a petition has gone viral online against an Oxford University faculty member for his racist and Hindu-phobic remarks against the first female Indian student to be elected as the university's union president. Now, do you believe such campaigns can reduce racial attacks?
The recent comments that have been made against the first female student of Indian origin who was elected as the president of the union in Oxford University just indicates that these racist tendencies and the colonial mindset has not disappeared even from persons who would consider to be educated. You believe that education, especially education in a reputed educational institution, in a reputed university, would make your mind a little broader, that you would be not just tolerant, you wouldn't be negatively stereotyping persons who don't look like you, who don't come from, whose origins are different from you, whose ethnic background is different from yours, who may not speak English in the same language, in the same accent that you do, whose color of skin, the color of that person's skin may be different. But you find that this strong colonial mindset and racist attitudes are prevalent and strong even in persons you would consider quote-unquote educated. And that's most unfortunate, but it's true.
Today, prejudice against Indians manifests itself in many ways through insults on social media and even bigoted remarks in Western mainstream or printed media. So who is responsible and what actions should be made?
The ease of transmitting information, distributing information on the social media has made the social media a classic double-edged sword that cuts both ways. Most people are addicted to the social media because it provides them a lot of information, it provides them entertainment, it enables them to contact people they wish to contact, their families, their friends, their professional colleagues. But at the same time, that sword has two edges, and the dark side of the social media and the internet is that it is used to disseminate hateful, fake, false negative stereotypes of different groups and different sections of society, often minorities and underprivileged sections. And this has been on the rise in India, and I guess in many, many other parts of the world, many, many other countries in the world. So in countries where laws exist, these laws should be strictly implemented. The law enforcing agencies should take stern action and advance action before hateful speech escalates into violence. So that is not easy, I agree. The law enforcing agencies have a difficult task ahead of them. End-to-end encryption, like that's what is provided by a messaging platform like WhatsApp. Again, you can say it protects your privacy, it safeguards freedom of expression, but there's the other side of the story. Freedom of expression is not the freedom to propagate hate. Freedom of expression does not mean that you can say something which is not just hateful, but which is incendiary, which incites violence. So, whereas in the Indian Constitution, the right to free expression is a fundamental right given to every citizen, there is also Article 19.2, which imposes what are called reasonable restrictions on the right to free speech. The problem is this word reasonable. Who decides what is reasonable? And that leaves for a lot of scope for arbitrary interpretation of the rules and laws. I think all countries in the world should implement laws which act against those who spread hate speech.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Tokota for his precious time and knowledge. And now, let's take a look at people's opinion on this matter on social media and cyberspace.
Politics of Envy believes the Indophobia in the UK is mixed with the Islamophobia, and these problems cannot be resolved in isolation. Anubis has talked about the high rates of Indophobia in Germany, suggesting that German media outlets should employ more Indian writers or journalists. Sai Swarupa has talked a lot about the Indophobia in the mainstream media. She points out that in every major global development, the Western media tries to project that India is on the wrong side. Abhish Banerj is a stern critic of Indian liberals. He says they are somehow highlighting the Indophobia to downgrade the rise of India as a country.
And that was our episode on the negative stereotyping of the subcontinental identity in the Western media and culture. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Johan Rockström, the director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, said the current extreme weather anomalies in British Columbia were not represented in global computer models that are used to project how the world might change with more greenhouse gas emissions. We're prepared for you an article written by Jonathan Watts. The piece is titled Canadian Inferno, Northern Heat Exceeds Worst-Case Climate Models. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Jonathan Watts's article. If you were drawing up a list of possible locations for hell on earth in recent days, the small mountain village of Lytton in British Columbia, Canada, would probably not have entered your mind. Few people outside British Columbia had heard of this community of just 250 people. Those who had were more likely to think of it as a bucolic. Nestled by a confluence of rivers in the forested foothills of the Lillooet and Botany Mountain Ranges, the municipal website boasts, Lytton is the ideal location for nature lovers to connect with incredible natural beauty and fresh air freedom. However, over the past 7 days, the village has made headlines around the world for a freakishly prolonged and intense temperature spike that turned the idyllic location into an inferno. The U.S. President Joe Biden and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau have warned worried populations to brace for more extremely hot weather. Shocked climate scientists are wondering how even worst-case scenarios failed to predict such furnace-like conditions so far north. Johan Rockström, the director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, said the recent extreme weather anomalies were not represented in global computer models that are used to project how the world might change with more greenhouse gas emissions. The fear is that weather systems might be more frequently blocked as a result of human emissions. He said, "It is a risk of a serious regional weather impact triggered by global warming that we have underestimated so far." In Lytton, in British Columbia, in Western Canada, it felt as if the weather itself had stagnated. Trapped in a vast heat dome that enveloped Western Canada and Northwestern United States, temperatures had nowhere to go but up. In Lytton, the Canadian national heat record was broken on Monday, 28th of June, smashed on Tuesday, and then obliterated on Wednesday, 30th of June, when the local monitoring station registered an amazing 49.6 degrees Celsius, 121 degrees Fahrenheit. After the insufferable heat came choking fire. First, the forest burned, then parts of the town. On Wednesday evening, 30th of June, the mayor, Jan Polderman, issued the evacuation order. He said on television, "It's dire. The whole town is on fire." It took like a whole 15 minutes from the first sign of smoke to all of a sudden there being fire everywhere. By Thursday, 1st of July, satellite images showed an eruption of blazes around the village of Lytton and a widening smoke cloud across the region. Police stations and hospitals